Hello, this is the Online Resilience Podcast with me, Louisa Street, and Professor Andy Phippin. We're discussing all aspects of young people's online lives and giving practical advice on how to support the young people you work with. Music is by Rue Pascoe. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Online Resilience Podcast. Today we're talking about online hate and conspiracy theories and how you can, as somebody working with young people, supporting young people, how you can respond to these things. It can be a really difficult subject to approach, particularly if you don't know very much about the online communities that these sort of beliefs can circulate in, particularly around conspiracy theories. What we want to do today is talk about how you can tackle the reasons for people's beliefs rather than the beliefs themselves. The reason for that is because sometimes people might believe in a lot of conspiracy theories and they will probably know a lot more about those things than you do. And if you say, oh, no, but that's definitely not true, you can just kind of push them into being defensive or push them further underground, which can obviously be risky. Andy, do you want to talk a bit about how online hate and conspiracy theories make young people vulnerable?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's again one of those things where you kind of think, oh, well, you know, how do they believe this stuff? I mean, you know, the Andrew Tate one was a great example of that. I think I shared a tweet with you where someone was saying that they listened out of their window and they saw a young man from across the street who was clearly listening to Andrew Tate videos and how terrible it was for the family. And you just go, well, at no point did you sort of unpick why that young man might be listening to that sort of thing. And they might be critically looking at it and think, yeah. it was immediately sort of clutching the pearls and going how terrible it was. But yeah. I think we also need to reflect upon the fact that this isn't just something that affects young people.
Yeah.
You know, this was the hilarious thing about, I think it was Keir Starmer who said a while ago that they're going to make the sharing of disinformation illegal. It's like, well, every politician in the country is going to be absolutely screwed in political campaigning, aren't they? You know, next election, because, you know, they come up with things like, oh, using untruths or post-fact agendas, yeah. and those sorts of things. So yeah, first of all, let's reflect upon the fact that it's not something that just affects young people. But yeah, you know, in the same way that, you know, it used to be worrying about people getting involved in cults, this is what a lot of this stuff is, essentially. It does make you, you know, vulnerable to exploitation, whether that's financial exploitation or sexual exploitation or whatever else. And once you're locked into these sorts of things, then coming out of those sorts of things, again, you don't have to just look at online versions of this. You know, there've been a couple of things about people moving away from particular religious organizations and how they were not just excommunicated, but massively attacked by those communities as well. So,
yeah.
You know, there are some very serious outcomes to come from these sorts of things. So it's not something where you can sort of just dismiss it. Oh, you're being silly. Don't take any notice of that sort of thing. Like understanding why they're there. And as you said, you know, understanding how you might get someone to appreciate that maybe that person that's giving you all those simple truths or easy solutions to life, maybe they're doing it because they want you to pay a subscription to the website at the end of every month, rather than maybe they're doing it because they want you to have a better life. So I think,
yeah.
You know, one of the things that both you and I very much agree on is you don't sort of like dismiss their views and you don't tell them, oh, this person is stupid or evil or whatever.
Yeah.
Try to unpick and understand where these beliefs come from and why people are susceptible to these sorts of things is quite an important aspect of it.
Definitely. And I think maybe it's because there's a secret part of me that is a bit of a conspiracy theorist, but I have a lot of sympathy with people who believe in some conspiracy theories because some of them have turned out to be true. And you know, if you are sort of following that alternative media telling of the world, then it might seem like, yeah, there is more going on than appears to be going on, and other people are just accepting what the mainstream media is saying. And actually, that is a really positive skill that somebody is displaying by saying, I am reading the mainstream media in a critical way. Actually, we should be supporting that and celebrating that essentially as like a really good skill to be developing. But I read a really brilliant article in The Conversation, which I'll link to in the show notes. And it basically said a really good way to respond to people who are kind of saying this stuff about like not believing the mainstream media is to say, like, it's really good that you're thinking critically about this, but we also have to think critically about the things that we agree with, not just the things that we disagree with. So talking to them about that and saying, you know, like, you might like this version of events better than that version of events, but can you apply the same critical thinking to both? Because then you can kind of encourage them to think more deeply about the subject. And that can also help as an approach rather than just saying, no, you're wrong because X, Y, and Z.
I think, you know, it's kind of odd that for many, many years, when you talk to young people about tackling any aspect of online harms, they will generally talk about critical thinking. And you know, I think the arguments we make around how you deal with online hate and how you bring critical thinking to that and look for evidence-based arguments, things, it's exactly the same thing that you might do if you were taking a critical approach to pornography.
Yeah.
That's kind of like, well, what are you actually seeing here? Is it two people having sex? No, it's not. It's a film scene. Why is that film scene being made? Because they want to produce content that people see. Why are they producing content that people see? Because then they can make more money from ads.
Yeah.
You know, that's a critical response to the industry of pornography rather than going, don't look at porn, it's bad.
Yeah, and I think the thing that's really, that can be really powerful about doing that and challenging young people to consider the agenda of the person, whether it's an influencer or someone they've been chatting to online, is that you can get them to do it to you as well. Say, like, what do you think my agenda is in talking to you about this? Because we should also acknowledge to young people that if we're saying, like, oh yeah, you know, this influencer who is ultimately trying to get you to subscribe to their whatever it might be service, they have this agenda. What do you think my agenda is in talking to you about it? And they might say, like, oh, well, you've got my best interests at heart. Or they might say, oh, well, you don't want me to do X, Y, and Z. Or you want to, you know, particularly if you're a parent, they might be like, well, you don't want me to put your credit card details into this website. Like, it's okay to do that. It's okay to admit that we do have an agenda as adults as well.
No, I think, you know, I think if you look at the recent Russell Brand stuff, that's been really quite interesting because he almost teed up an expectation that this stuff was going to break. So he'd already built a narrative around the fact that don't believe these people, believe me, and oh, you can come on. And, you know, it was very well cultivated. But looking at that from a critical perspective, rather than going, anyone who likes Russell Brand must be a terrible human being, cause, or the classic thing, I don't know whether it's all people of her age, but my mum tells me, just in the same way she told me that she never liked Jimmy Savile, oh, I never liked that Russell Brand.
Right.
Kind of interesting. It always happens post-event.
Yeah.
But yeah, understanding that approach and the fact he was cultivating an alternative narrative on YouTube, but now it's moved on to Rumble because YouTube have pulled it. I think the other thing to explore, because, you know, the mainstream media and those sorts of things, you can find examples where the mainstream media was wrong. You can find lots of examples where the mainstream media delivered one side of an argument, but at least it's regulated. Again, looking at it from a critical perspective, it's like, well, yeah, if that happens, you can make complaints. And then there is a regulator. However, someone posting stuff up on an unregulated online space isn't able to be challenged on these sorts of things. So, finding an alternative narrative is one thing. Finding an alternative narrative that fits in with your worldview is completely unregulated and just tells you what you want to hear isn't necessarily doing your research. It's confirmation bias. Which, again, is a useful thing to sort of explore.
Definitely. And I, you know, I wasn't going to talk about this today, but it's come up, so I will. I have extremely complicated feelings about J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter. The reason that I have complicated feelings about it is because I don't agree with any of what she comes out and says about trans people. I feel like she's, you know, pushing a narrative that I really don't agree with. And yet it doesn't change the fact that for years I really loved reading Harry Potter and it was a really important part of my life and it really helped me process things and difficult things that I was struggling with. And I think from that, from, you know, like I still have uncomfortable feelings about that. So I'm not coming at this from a perspective of like, so this is what you should do and everything will be fine. But also, I think it's okay to just sit with that sometimes and say, like, this makes me feel really uncomfortable and I don't know how to feel about it. Mm-hmm. And if you can say that to a young person and say, you know, actually, it's okay if you like some of what this person has done, but you don't like all of what they've done, it's okay to feel uncomfortable about it. We don't have to have a solution that just, you know, feels really easy. But I think sometimes we shy away from just accepting that discomfort and say, like, well, no, I have to throw away all of my Harry Potter books and never mention it ever again. And, you know, I know there's been similar things about other famous people who have been accused of things and have been, in scare quotes, cancelled. The question of, like, do we still listen to this person's music? Do we still watch the content that they've created? It's not, there isn't an easy answer. I don't think anybody, if anyone claims to have an easy answer, I think they're kind of missing some of the nuance to it.
But that relates very strongly to what's happened with politics and how it's been driven by a lot of the social media world is, you have to take a side and you have to have an opinion.
Yeah.
You know, it's very unusual where someone will go, you don't need to have an opinion on this. And it's kind of like, oh, you either have to look at them as a goodie or a baddie. There's no nuance. There's no subtlety. There's no. And you can probably track that back to things like, you know, Brexit vote and things as well. You know, if you don't want to talk about misinformation, the $350 million to the NHS every week on the side of a bus the day after the Brexit vote, Farage is on TV going, well, I never said that.
Yeah.
So you know, it's not just the extreme examples you sort of need to explore. And again, going back to critical thinking around these things, you can kind of see that J.K. Rowling is now locked in her own echo chamber and has to say these things because she gets lots of encouragement when she does it. You can see how people will take, if they become an influencer, will take a more and more extreme position because they need to generate the traffic and they need to generate the attention, all those sorts of things. And these are all very reasonable things to explore with young people.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, why is that person saying that? Is that person saying that because they believe it, or are they saying that because if they say that, then they're going to get lots of likes as a result? You know, you can spend 5 minutes looking at the local pages on Facebook, and as I mentioned before, it's something of a hobby of mine. Guaranteed 50, 60 likes on a local page. If you go, oh, why don't they ban fireworks because it upsets my cats? you know, like, how many people need to say that? But it just becomes an endless iteration because people like attention.
Yeah.
And people like getting likes. And and then it sort of triggers an argument then. And then I'm trying to think what, you know, some of the other ones that have been flying around recently, you know, fireworks are bad for the environment. It's like weird. But even at a local level, when you're talking, you look at something like, you know, we're both living in Cornwall. Cornwall Live will post up the most ridiculous news stories and have a strong opinion about it. And that will generate a huge amount of traffic. So they have been successful because everyone that clicks on that link and goes to their website, they pick up advertising revenue, because if you've ever been on the Cornwall Live website, it's virtually impossible to look at because there's so much advertising on it.
The worst.
So maybe that's why they were doing it. Maybe they were doing it not because they think that Meghan's evil, but if they do that, then people will go on it and then have a big rage about how, you know, well, we always knew and that Harry was the wrong one there, and, you know, all this bizarre nonsense where everyone's got strong opinions about people they've never met, they're never going to meet.
And I think the thing that's challenging, if you're working with a young person and they say something to you that you see as a conspiracy theory, or that you see as like the forerunner of the kind of online misogyny or online hate, like, oh, the patriarchy doesn't exist, people have equal rights, women just don't have the same biology as men to make them competitive enough to make them more successful in the workplace. Now, if someone said that to me, like, even me saying that out loud, my hackles are rising and I want to say, no, but it's not true because of this, and this. And you've got to talk about systemic inequality. If somebody is sort of saying that stuff for effect, then by responding to it in that way, we're giving them exactly what they want.
Yep.
If they're saying it because they believe it, then shouting at them about systemic and structural inequality is probably not going to actually change their mind. So in the same way as, and I know I've talked before about like the referring back to your kind of safeguarding training, where if a young person discloses something to you, you're not meant to get angry, even if you feel angry that something really awful has happened to that young person, because that's not a helpful reaction for that young person. And I think in a similar way, we have to, in a professional capacity, kind of hold on to our own feelings and not let that inform how we respond to what young people are saying, and not get angry with them, and instead, you know, say, okay, tell me why you think that, or like let's think critically about this, let's unpick some of what you're saying.
I think a lot of it ties back to the fact that, you know, again, through a lot of online discourse, folk have forgotten what the nature of debate is. I remember an Ofsted inspection of a school I was involved with a while ago being told young people do not have the opportunity to debate here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a debate isn't saying what you think and then not listening to the other person and then going online and finding a video of a chap proving what you said was right and then playing it to them and laughing at them. However, that's a fairly typical online discourse.
Yeah.
In the same way that if a young person expresses a view saying, well, you're wrong, shut up, or I'm not having that in my classroom because that's unacceptable or whatever. Yeah, I mean, obviously there are boundaries to that. If they are actually venturing into hate speech, you have to challenge that. But saying you're not allowed to say that, or you're not allowed to think that, is a guaranteed way of driving someone deeper down that rabbit hole, because what they're being told by the people in the rabbit hole are, well, people won't like you saying it and they'll try and shut you down, which is why you've got people on both the left and the right banging on about freedom of expression, then trying to shut down the other side.
Yeah.
Which is just bizarre, you know.
Yeah.
We're free speech champions as long as you agree with us.
Yeah. So,
you know, there are some very interesting and complex things to sort of unpick here. And yeah, you know, regardless of your belief system, if someone is saying something that challenges that belief system, you are going to sort of go, no, that's completely wrong. But that's not what debate is.
Definitely.
You know, the concept of winning by shutting somebody up isn't really, you know, you're supposed to be seeing the other person's viewpoint and understanding what that viewpoint is.
I mean, it wouldn't be an episode of this podcast if I didn't recommend another podcast. So I'm going to do that now. There is a great episode of Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, Revisionist History, where he talks about a debate that he did, where he essentially did really badly and just tried to shout the other person down and didn't listen to what they were saying and came out of it really badly. And so then went to debate school and learned how to debate. And I think it's a really interesting podcast to listen to. And one of the really important things that came out of it for me is that when if you're looking at who's won a debate, you're actually looking at who convinced the most people who didn't feel strongly either way at the beginning. If you've got people who are like, I already 100% know how I feel about this, they're probably not going to have their opinion changed by reasoned debate. But I think, you know, having that like openness to discuss stuff without sort of just shutting somebody down and saying your opinion is invalid because this is what the party line is.
I think as well, it's kind of like you don't have to use the ignition points to develop debating skills and debating sort of behaviours within the classroom. So, you know, having a debate about Andrew Tate is probably a waste of time. But having a debate around influencers, are they a good or a bad thing, is actually going to be far more useful, because you can still explore exactly the same things, but without having that flashpoint there as well.
Definitely. And I think that, again, it's that thing of don't try and humiliate the person. Don't try and tell them, look, everybody else thinks you're wrong too. Because, again, if their online community is saying people don't want you to know this, then,
Or the QAnon thing about do your own research. What's that basically saying is find something where you agree with it. You know, there are a lot of things, certainly within the hard sciences and things, where facts have been tested and there isn't an alternative perspective on it.
Yeah.
But when it comes to opinions and beliefs and those sorts of things, just saying, no, I disagree with you, shut up, or, well, that's wrong because I said so, which is a particularly poor educational tool.
Yeah.
To say, I'm an adult, you're a young person, so you've got to listen to me.
Yeah.
When they might have something to say.
Yeah. Definitely. And I mean, I did a session at a school a couple of years ago, and it had taken the class a little while to warm up. And then after about 20 minutes of me really working hard to get them to share their opinions, we started having a really good conversation, and there were different viewpoints, and everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people in the class felt able to kind of share their opinion. And I came out of it feeling like it was a great session, even though people were saying things that I didn't necessarily agree with. But the teachers afterwards were like, oh, we don't normally give them an opportunity to share their opinions in,
oh, no.
in PSHE, in a PSHE lesson. We don't give them the opportunity to share their opinions. And, you know, I don't want to seem like I'm saying, oh, they're doing it all wrong, because I'm sure there's lots of reasons. If you've got an hour of PSHE and then you've got to do an hour of maths immediately afterwards, then maybe you don't want to always open that can of worms. But somebody much more intelligent than me, and I can't remember who it was, pointed out that if you did have a can of worms and you took the lid off, you would still have a can of worms.
Exactly. Worms
would take time to come out of the can.
You know, so, you wouldn't expect a science lesson to be debating whether water boils at 100 degrees Celsius.
No.
Although depending on atmospheric conditions, it might boil at a different temperature anyway.
Yeah.
But you know, if there are areas where we haven't got hard facts, just saying I'm right and you're wrong is, you know, and it goes back to one of the absolute fundamentals of developing a progressive approach around online harms. We will want an environment where young people will be confident to disclose and get help if they're worried about something.
Yes, definitely.
So saying, oh, someone disclosing that they've been looking at a lot of Andrew Tate stuff and they've really upset people, and they've lost a bunch of their friends, or they've been dumped, or whatever the response to that shouldn't be. Well, that's because you've been watching Andrew Tate videos, isn't it? or anything like that. You know, the head-on approach generally doesn't work.
And no.
Again, talking about what stuff other folk have written, and if you could put this as show notes as well, but Emily Setti's piece in The Conversation that looked at, you know, understanding why boys might be attracted to that sort of rhetoric rather than just saying, don't listen to him, he's a bad man.
Yeah.
There was a terrible BBC interview with him a while ago where he, you know, he knew exactly what was going to happen. And this reporter basically just shouted him and went, you're bad, you're mean, you're horrible.
Yeah.
And he just went, oh, this is exactly what you expect from the people that hosted Jimmy Savile for all those years. And she's just going, yes, but you're awful. There was no, you know, it's kind of like, well, what was your goal of this interview? You knew he was going to behave like this.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no way he was going to go, oh, yeah, fair enough, actually.
Yeah.
All that money I'm pulling in from like exploiting all these people, actually, I'll stop that now because you said I'm bad. Yeah. You know, it's just kind of like that doesn't work. It was really weird. It was a really weird interview.
It was very cringy. I'm not going to put a link to that in the show notes.
No, best not.
To inflict that on anyone.
I'm sure it's online somewhere.
Yeah. I think that's really important as well. Like this sort of stuff, challenging some of these ideas in a very gentle way and encouraging the critical thinking and all of that, is going to be most successful if it comes from somebody that young person trusts.
Yeah.
That might not be you, whoever you are listening to the podcast. You might not be the right person to challenge this with a young person. And something that I was reflecting on recently is actually the importance of recognizing our different roles in young people's lives. And if you're someone who is aware of an issue with a young person, but you know you don't have the relationship with them to discuss it, that's fine. There's probably another young person that you do have the relationship with who you would be the go-to person. So it's fine to say, okay, well, I know they have a good relationship with this teacher, so maybe I'll talk it over with them. Or if you're a social worker, I know they've got a good relationship with, you know, their auntie or their youth worker, or, you know, just recognizing the different roles we all have in those young people's lives and finding who's going to be best placed to have this conversation.
Yeah, I think that goes back to, you know, what we say is that you don't have to be the hero.
Yeah.
You don't have to be the person that solves all of the problems.
Yeah.
Because they might not want have a problem they want solving. They might just want to ask questions.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, you know, or, you know, it's all right to go, I don't know, I'll go and find that out for you, and then get back to them about it, rather than just going, I don't know, I'll find that out about you, then never speaking to them about it again.
Let's never mention this again.
Because you've got them out of your classroom and you can go to lunch now.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
My favourite conspiracy theory is the Paul McCartney is dead, conspiracy theory. And I once spent quite a lot of time on forums where people discuss this, and it is, you know, not trying to be rude about people who believe it, it's quite wild. Some of the thing, and the fact that like a lot of this is based on people not actually wanting any evidence.
Yeah,
evidence is the death of the conspiracy theory.
Emotion versus evidence, isn't it? You know.
Yeah.
I will find whatever it is that aligns with you know, what I want to believe. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's wide ranging, and you know, I think both of us have said before, sometimes they're true. You know, the more extreme end of the digital rights world, where people were saying there's illegal government surveillance going on, and they were all dismissed as tin foil hat wearing conspiracy theorists. Then Edward Snowden came along and went, you know that, what you're saying about governments is doing all comms? Yeah, that happens.
Here's the evidence.
and everyone went, this is terrible. So yeah, you know, there are occasionally examples where it is correct, or you know, you get a declassification happening, and then all of a sudden something that sounded absolutely barking years ago is actually found out to be true.
Yeah. So yeah, we should always, you know, kind of remember to be respectful and not just assume that because it doesn't fit with our belief system that it's necessarily wrong. And yeah, I mean, I think sort of summing some of that up, the idea that, yeah, we don't tell young people that they're wrong. We challenge them to think more critically about the stuff they do agree with. We challenge them to think about the agenda of the people that they believe, and we're open to them challenging us about our agenda. Hopefully all of that put together will create a good environment.
People's viewpoint. I think the other thing as well, which, you know, from both of us that work in the academic world as well, this idea that I found a peer-reviewed article, therefore it's right, I think does a disservice to the folk will hide it, but it's been peer-reviewed. All peer-reviewed basically means it's two or three people have looked at it and gone, yeah, this seems sound. It doesn't mean it's right, particularly in areas like the social sciences and politics and all, where there isn't a right or a wrong answer.
Yeah.
Discovering a peer-reviewed article that aligns with your beliefs is still confirmation bias. It's gone through a scientific process, and it's likely to be written in a higher quality than someone just screaming on the internet. But it doesn't mean that because you found an article that's been published in a journal, that means you are right and anyone else is wrong. You know, there have been, and I always give an example of the violent video games, make violent children things. The vast majority of literature now says that's incorrect.
Yeah.
But you will, every couple of years, someone will come out and they'll have done a survey with young people and they'll go, do you think video games make you violent? Yes, no. And some of them will go, yes. And then that'll be published as a peer-reviewed article that proves that young people are made violent by playing violent video games.
Yeah.
Just because it's peer-reviewed doesn't mean it's fact.
And I think that's really important as well, because I think we can all be, I say we can all be, I think it, you know, from my experience when I was a youth worker, it's very easy to kind of feel a little bit intimidated by academia. And if something's published in a peer-reviewed journal, then, you know, it's difficult to say, yeah, I don't agree with that, though. There will probably also, if, particularly, as you say, in the social sciences, there will be other peer-reviewed stuff that says the opposite. Yeah. And again,
bring your critical thinking to it. It's kind of like, what was the sample size? What was the methodology? What was the inquiry? What was the goal of the inquiry? What were the results of the inquiry? Have the media reporting on the paper actually misrepresented it? You know, there's all those sorts of things as well. So again, critical thinking is really, really important.
Yeah.
There are some areas like climate change where 99% of academics agree with that, where you'd be hard pushed to sort of go, oh, no, there's alternative viewpoints on that. But that's generally based on hard science.
Yeah.
Looking at areas of qualitative inquiry, areas of ethnographic inquiry and similar, then.
Yeah,
you know, the reason that stuff is published is to move the debates forward.
Definitely.
Not because someone's proven something. In fact, if I ever examine a PhD where someone says, my thesis has proved this, I'll go, yeah, now you want to rewrite that, mate.
Yeah.
Let's do a little bit of work on this, shall we? You've spoken to 50 people. What have you proved?
I proved that these 50 people said what I recorded. I think the other thing I would add to your list there is whose voices are present and whose are absent. It's very easy to find a group of, you know, like-minded people with very similar backgrounds and experiences who will all say the same thing. And that, I think, is where you see it on adverts for beauty cream, of like, oh, 67 of 111 people agreed. And if that number seems really weird, it's because they were trying to get to a particular percentage. So I think that's a really good place to wrap up. So unless you've got anything you want to add on.
Would recommend one other book, which is the Other Pandemic by James Ball, which explores the conspiracy theories around QAnon in much detail and comes to the conclusion that we need public health models around tackling misinformation. And you know, which states that there is no one stakeholder that can solve this, and it's around critical thinking and critical education and supportive professionals and sorts of things and data. But
brilliant.
There's no one solution to these sorts of things. It's also a really interesting read as well.
Right. I'll add it. I think I've got it on my reading
list.
Yeah. Cool. I will pop all that and all of the other things that we've mentioned in the show notes. So if you want to do some more reading, do your research, then that will be there. And we will see you in a couple of weeks with another podcast. That's it for another episode of the Online Resilience Podcast. If you liked it, please tell someone you know who might also enjoy it. You can share on Facebook, Twitter, or even just pop a link in an email.